Welcome to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity International University. I'm Matthew Epinette, Executive Director of the Center. This edition of the podcast features an interview I did recently via Zoom with Christina Twitty, a graduate of the MA Bioethics program here at Trinity. One of the things I'm grateful to be able to do with this podcast is highlight graduates of the bioethics degree program so that others can get to know them and learn about the work they're doing, building upon their academic training. Before we turn to the interview, I want to let you know that we've extended the deadline for the call for proposals for our 2022 summer conference until December 6. We invite healthcare and other professionals, scholars, researchers, educators, and students to address questions associated with our conference theme, which is integrity and conscience, or to engage broadly with other bioethical issues that arise at the intersection of medicine, science, technology, and our common humanity. The deadline for proposals has been extended to Monday, December 6. For more information and to submit a proposal, visit cbhd.org and choose Call for Proposals from the conference drop-down menu at the top of the page. My guest this week is Christina Twitty. In this interview, we'll get to know Christina and hear about how she came to be interested in the issues of bioethics. And she'll tell us about a new venture she started to assist people in thinking through the personal implications of various decisions regarding life and health, particularly choices around reproductive technologies, as well as decisions that come to the fore nearer to the end of life. Here's an interview with Christina Twitty, bioethicist, speaker, advocate, entrepreneur, and more. Welcome. It's great to have you here, Christina. Tell us about yourself. How did you get interested in kind of life issues in general? And then how did you get interested more specifically in bioethics? First, just a little bit of background.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. I am an early learner from CBHD and the podcasts long before I got into this. So it's really neat to kind of come full circle with this. I am the oldest of five kids. I was a homeschooled kid before it was cool. My parents were both teachers in South Georgia shortly after college and getting married and having me. And so I would say I grew up more in Georgia, Tennessee, Illinois. We lived in Wheeling, actually not too far from Trinity, and friends of my parents lived with us or stayed with us for an extended amount of time while they were going to school there. So I probably would say that my early interest in life issues started just being the oldest of five kids. By the time my youngest sibling was born, I was in seventh grade. I was convinced I wanted to be a midwife, but my math and science were not my strengths. I more gravitated towards language and communication. So it wasn't really until the next year that I could really articulate much of an argument on life. And it was because I'd seen a billboard, a little black and white silhouette of a baby inside a circle and the umbilical cord running to the outside that just simply said, she's a child, not a choice. And so that's what I ended up writing my eighth grade paper on for a competition that year. In the next few years, being a 4-H'er, doing public speaking, I could pick my topic within some parameters. And so I started writing about this, talking to the pregnancy center, finding out statistics, what makes a girl come to them, kind of what's really going on in the world, and covering everything from pregnancy issues to politics. And that year in particular, it was Bill Clinton and George Walker, Herbert Walker Bush running for president. And so I, of course, had to include the difference between the platforms of the parties. I think I probably made my 4-H leaders nervous here and there because they knew I like to talk about tough stuff. But that was kind of the early on life issues.
Yeah. And then how did you get drawn into the sort of world of bioethics beyond just the kind of life issues that people are maybe most familiar with?
Well, I was 21 when I moved to Washington, D.C. and worked for Congressman Dave Weldon. This was 1999. He was one of two physicians in the House, and there was a lot of talk about cloning in his office. So I would say that was my first introduction. Dolly the Sheep had just been born a couple of years earlier. There was a lot of concern in the pro-life community, especially that this kind of experimentation with animals would eventually move to humans, and concern for the life issue and sanctity of it, starting at an embryonic stage, and what would that actually look like. So I heard about it then, but went on to work on education policy when I went to Eagle Forum not too long after that. So it really wasn't an opportunity to get much deeper. However, in 2005, I moved out to St. Louis to work for a congressional office there. And within a few months, I was enrolled at Covenant Seminary just to get a community and a theological depth somewhere to really be involved. And I'd heard about this bioethics program, but it was kind of off in the distance somewhere. It wasn't really a big draw to me, partly because it was a term I hadn't been familiar with. You know, even though cloning and Dolly the sheep was something I knew about, I hadn't really dug into what that actually looks like. But Missouri, at the state legislative level, had been trying to pass a ban on human cloning for several years, and they had not managed to do it. So, partly because there were some researchers involved and lots of money on the table, there is a particular family that wanted to see it protected. And so they basically bought themselves a constitutional amendment, had it go on the ballot in 2006. And as I started learning more of the nitty-gritty of how cloning happens, so what they do with Dolly the sheep, now they're going to do with human beings, which is exactly what the Weldon office was concerned about to begin with. I sat and watched a speech by the, what they called the Missouri Cures side of things, because of course they were pitching this like, you know, the new fountain of youth that was going to cure everyone and everything of any ailment ever. And I heard people asking questions about what happens to embryos when they get researched on, or the core stem cells get pulled out so that they can do embryonic stem cell research. And as little as I knew then, just reading a few articles and getting an idea of exactly what cloning looked like from that kind of, you know, young embryo stage, I was infuriated to listen to speakers who were supposedly experts on this research completely refuse to answer the question about what happens to embryos when you pull out their stem cells. Mm-hmm. Sometimes anger can drive you to great things. This one drove me back to Diane Preston at Covenant Theological Seminary. And I said, okay, you've got this bioethics thing. What is it? I don't have a medical background. I don't really have a great science background, but I think I might need to do this. And she smiled and nodded. And she says, sometimes God does that. So she helped me to rearrange my program. Of course, very theology heavy. Mm-hmm. With being a Covenant Seminary, but added the bioethics classes, a lot of which were adjunct through the weekend. My advisor had graduated from Trinity's program. Mm-hmm. So when we started to run up against some of the issues of how many classes I was going to need for the bioethics portion, we pulled Trinity in, and I transferred to Trinity from Covenant and transferred Trinity back to Covenant and just started inhaling everything I could get my hands on. It married for me politics, life, and theology. And it was like the three loves of my life. And all three of those became my passion.
So you did a degree at Covenant, and then you even more recently have done a degree here at Trinity.
That's right. I started in just a biblical theological studies program at Covenant. When I switched for the focus in bioethics, it added that side of it too, as well. I graduated in 2008. Then for the next almost 10 years, just kind of stayed in the field, kept reading, kept buying books. You thought I was still in school. By the way, I still spent money on books. But then thanks to some former church connections in St. Louis and kind of the heads up that Dr. John Kilner was now the director, or at the time was the director of the bioethics program at Trinity. Having had him as a professor before, I got back in touch with him, said, hey, I want to use my Covenant transcript, you know, 10 of my hours are actually from you guys. So can I use that and come back and finish off? And he worked with me to do that. So I started classes in 2016. It took me a while, but that's what grad school's for. Take you a while and get done.
Right.
So I graduated last spring with the master's in bioethics there from Trinity.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I'm wanting to use the podcast to do is visit with alum of the program and find out what they're doing now. And you've just recently started a new project, a new program, a new organization, I guess, called Decision Care Advocates. Tell us about where did the inspiration for that come from? Was there a particular person? And then tell us about what you do, getting it started, all just all the things.
I could talk for a month. You might not want to ask me that question. I would say first off, inspiration came from just who I was learning from, who I was learning with. Toward the end of my initial program, I started a life team at Kirk of the Hills, PCA Church down the road from the seminary. I had the sweet support of the pastoral staff that put me in the pulpit for two Sanctity of Life Sundays in a row to talk about the life team, to talk about unexpected pregnancy one year and talk about transhumanism the next year. Of course, you could hear a pin drop on a carpeted floor when you start talking about transhumanism. But I was just inspired by the reality of, you know, God having an answer to this and the foundation being about human beings made in his image with the reality of heaven and the new body that we will be given as an answer to the panic so many people, even in the science community, have. They want to live forever because this is the only life you get, you know, kind of thing. So to start talking with people about the issues I was learning about through that life team, we then created an 8-week Sunday school class and we packed the room out. And my pastor had no expectation that we would. Yeah. And we have a standing room only the whole time, all 8 weeks. And the teachers that I was able to pull in, I used Barb Quigley, who had been my advisor, Dr. Jay Whippold, who I subsequently introduced to CBHD, and my own ethics professor from Covenant, David Jones, who had a passion for these things and a passion for learning new things as he went. And he had just retired. So he jokingly said that I was running his schedule. As soon as he retired, I snatched him up. And they actually, those three teachers actually continued to do that after I moved away for other churches to just give a little snapshot for people about what bioethics was. So that lit me up. The teaching side of that, the public speaking side of that, the coordinating of it, mm-hmm. the simplifying of complicated things that let people use the material and make decisions for themselves where they were, because everybody's in a different place and dealing with, you know, different things. So I say that was the first write off. Then when it came to some of the end of life things, I had a dear friend that had a sudden illness and 18 months in the hospital, nursing home, never went home again. Mm-hmm. And she, I can honestly tell you, that woman has written, had written more birthday cards to me than anybody in my life since I was 12 years old.
Wow.
So talking with her son about advocating for her when she couldn't speak for herself, when things got confusing, when decisions had to be made, and how decisions are made, and who's the power of attorney, and who makes her healthcare decisions, and that kind of thing, just gave a new element to it, I would say, mm-hmm. because this was all happening in the overlap of like the 2 years I feel like I spent on end of life issues at Trinity mm-hmm. during my program. So I would get articles and immediately turn around and highlight them all up and send them to him so he had something to mm-hmm. hold on to and make decisions with. So that was probably my first, lots of inspiration, I guess I would say, in answer to that question. Yeah.
And then you started when, like right before the pandemic, right? February 2020?
I did. Yes.
Is there anything particular about that was the moment to get going?
Well, I had probably been talking about doing it for about 2 years. And I spent a lot of time trying to come up with a name, to be honest. I was struggling to match that with a decent website name and how do you get the two together and in very few words explain what you do. So probably the timing not only had to do with that and just the name finally feel like dropping in my lap to explain caring for people and advocating for people through the decisions that they're making. It There's probably two things that made me launch exactly when I did, because in January, I started doing in-home senior care while I lived in Portland. And a couple of my clients were early onset dementia, and others were just 90 plus, others recovering from cancer, you know, just, you're getting to walk through and live a little bit of life with a hands-on urgency for some of them. And at the same time, I was asked by Oregon Right to Life to come do a workshop on the topic. So they gave me kind of a, what is bioethics and why should Christians care enough to know? So I got to start with all the theology that I love and reminding people who we are and whose we are and what we're here for, and salt and light of this issue, just like everything else. And there's always a lot of fun to that for me, because there's so much shock value in the issues that you talk about in bioethics that people literally sit on the front row and go, wait, is that for real?
Yeah,
that's for real. You know? So I would say that was the timing. We had not really been hit so much by COVID yet. And I was in Oregon, for heaven's sake. If anybody was going to be hit by COVID, it was Oregon. I think they're still hit by COVID now. And still a lot of my friends are living in the same restrictions and often on lockdowns as they were, gosh, a year and a half ago. So it's kind of funny to think about now, but because technology had been such a big part of people going to work remotely, it ended up actually being a gift. I had already put it in my brochure. I had already printed a big chunk of them. And my first clients were people that were in different cities. So getting them on a Zoom call made it easy to communicate. So all those things just, I don't know, God has a sense of humor, but also much better timing than I do.
So maybe we should back up. Give us the, you know, the elevator pitch. What is Decision Care Advocates?
I guess I'd say my elevator pitch is helping people navigate medical decisions at all ages and stages of life.
What are the big needs that you're seeing? Like, are there themes and questions that recur, or is it just everybody's different and everything's different?
Well, I can tell you that the majority of the conversations I've had recently are end of life issues. I think that 18 months of, you know, 24/7 newscast of panic over the pandemic has definitely started making people think a little bit more about what and how and when and why. But even before that, I saw a lot of regret in the conversations I was having with family members who didn't realize ahead of time that the financial plans that they had made didn't necessarily mean their loved one had communicated, or that they had communicated with their loved one about what they wanted for the end of life care. So like my physical body care is one thing, my financial care and who gets what and what happens to the house and the dog and the mail and the car and all of that is something completely different. And just a lot of pain there. So it was a motivator to me to talk more with people, try to get them ahead of time so that they're prepared for this. And then I would say the second issue is all the reproductive technology. I'm of the age now that friends 10 years younger to 5 or 10 years older are going, oh, wait, but yes, we do want a family. And now what? Because it's not happening the way we thought it would. And just those struggles that I saw people kind of going through the process and then getting to a point of, oh my gosh, nobody told us that we'd have to make that kind of decision. And that brought a lot of pain too. So just having compassion on both sides of those issues is what I tend to talk about the most and see the biggest need for, some of the, just to connect the dots. Just lay it out. What's really going on here? What are the concerns? What are some things you might want to think about? What's an alternative if you don't want to run into that decision? You know, where's that fork in the road for you? What do you foundationally believe that might impact the decisions that you're making?
And so what are the services that you're offering through that? Obviously, counseling, meeting with people one-on-one. Are there other things you're doing as well?
Yes. I am drawing from the public speaking, the kid that was petrified to speak in front of a crowd that got comfortable. Now it's not a crowd that bothers me and passionate about what I speak on. And so I offer that for workshops or classes. I do consults for pastors because I realize that it's not just a senior pastor that might be running into things, but I also offer a consult. If you want to pack a room full around a Zoom call, that's fine. If you want me there in person in Chattanooga, at least for now, and some of the surrounding areas I can get to pretty quickly, then I'll do that too. I offer an advocacy package that not only will have me walk into a doctor's office with you, but will let me advocate for you too. We work out what that's going to look like with the client before we do it. And so I price that a tad bit differently just for the sake of knowing what I'm getting myself into and as well. Just because I've, you know, having to do it before, you know, kind of informally and with family or with friends, I realized before COVID was ever an issue that hospital protocols are not tailor-made to patients. So if you want somebody tailor-making your plan, you need an advocate, whether it's a family member or someone else. It's just a little bit familiar with what your bent is and what you're hoping for. So I would say, guys, it's three kind of categories: the speaking, the advocacy, and the consulting. And then I break it out to that. I learned early on that a one-time planning visit might not be enough. So I created packages so people could get me ongoing, but for a lesser hourly cost. So they felt like they had somebody to go back to and I wasn't cut. They weren't cut off after that first, you know, first meeting.
So I can imagine people listening and they're kind of wondering how this work differs from that of, say, a hospital social worker or a chaplain.
I got asked that a lot when I first started. Well, why would you just not go work for a hospital? So, because I don't want to be paid by the hospital. I want to be paid by the person that needs me, to be objective, if that makes it a little clearer. Chaplains definitely have the theology background, but I get bioethics too. Because I spent this much time now, 15 plus years, inhaling everything I can and continuing to learn. I also, as you know, a lot of folks say, well, why don't you just go be a hospital social worker? Well, again, I don't want to be paid by the hospital. There's something to be said for being independent where you don't have skin in the game. Your recommendations aren't tied to your paycheck or how much money the hospital is going to get for the protocols that they're following or the things that they're prescribing or the services that they're offering. So that was probably the main thing. Somebody from the outside, fresh perspective.
So for now, it's just you, right? You've started this true entrepreneurial fashion, kicked it off, got it going. What are you thinking about in terms of growth? Is there sort of an ideal staff or maybe even an ideal like next person that you'd want to add to your team of you?
Yes, my team of me. Next person probably ideally would be somebody to help me do triage, somebody that I can direct some phone calls to and the initial consult requests, because I'll do a 30-minute introduction for people that don't know me, just so I get an idea of where they're coming from. They get to know me a little bit before they decide if they want to jump in and pay me to be walking through this with them. Mm-hmm. So I've set this up such that at least with technology, I could have somebody anywhere in the country check into the same email, pull up the same voicemail, kind of get some of that legwork done ahead of time and get things scheduled. Ideally, that would be somebody that has some flexibility in their schedule, but they don't have to necessarily have all the background that I do. Mm-hmm. But secondarily to that, I got to meet so many precious, wonderful, people-loving people in my classes that my long-term goal and hope is that I get to make colleagues out of my classmates down the road, where all over the country, people are dealing with these things and all over the country, people are needing help. And so as I go, because I've worked in a bunch of different states, I'm constantly adding to my list of people to approach, whether it's somebody that can do consults with me, for me, in person, in their own location, depending on where I get calls from, but also in just keeping good relationships with some friends who are family practice attorneys, estate planners, because inevitably the conversations I have with people lead them to realize, oh, you know, I hadn't really thought about that before. And so anything that they make decisions about with me, my next statement to them often is, you need to get it in writing and you need to make it legal, because this is just a conversation and you've done the lion's share of the work. Now go find, you know, go talk to an attorney. So that's kind of, you know, what those stages and what that vision is for growing beyond, beyond me and beyond where my, you know, circumference is to drive to in a day.
Yeah. I really like that, making colleagues out of classmates, which brings us back to kind of my initial desire when you'd mentioned this to me was, I just want to spotlight and highlight the work that bioethics degree program alum are doing. Work that they could do together is even better, I think. as we begin to wrap up, I guess what's maybe one thing you'd like to communicate to our listeners here today in the podcast?
I would say that any dilemma that you face, whether it's a struggle with infertility or terminal illness, my reminder and encouragement, I guess, would be that God offers himself in the details of brokenness and gives wisdom that comes from nowhere else. Yeah. I mean, knowledge is one thing, wisdom is another. And as confusing as some of these things might be, he does promise abundant wisdom when we ask him. That's where I would start.
And then finally, just a real practical question. If people are interested in getting in touch with you about a consultation, or if they're interested in working with you, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Website is best, but that's just because I'm doing triage myself right now.
give us the web address.
DecisionCareAdvocates.com.
Okay.
My phone number is there. My email is there. But for those of you who may not be on a computer a lot, my email is contact@DecisionCareAdvocates.com. And the phone number that's best is 770-765-6327. Again, the email contact@DecisionCareAdvocates.com and the phone number 770-765-6327. I have tried to make it pretty simple. There's package descriptions, there's a booking button there and all the information that's needed. But in anticipation of growing this, also on the contact page, there is a little blurb about working with us, because I just thought, let's put it out there now. We're going to grow. We're going to need more than just me. And so I asked for a resume and two reference letters and a little cover letter sent to that same email, that contact at decisioncareadvocates.com, because we're going to go.
Great. And now comes the point in every interview where the person says, and what did I not ask you about that you wanted to say?
What did I not ask you about? My joy in all of this and my underlying reason or desire, I don't know, is a lot more focused probably in the area of educating and equipping and encouraging the church. I saw such a need for it as I got my own classes. When I went back to school at Trinity, I remember saying, all the introductions you have to do of yourself when you're sitting in class or you're having to video yourself doing an introduction for class. I remember saying I felt like I could make a full-time job going to every Bible teaching seminary in the country and begging them not to graduate one more student for any kind of counseling, any kind of teaching, any kind of pastoral work without requiring a significant introduction to bioethics. Because I'd had enough conversations where pastors were asking, what do you do with leftover embryos? We've got people in church that had triplets and now they've got all these leftovers and they didn't think about what that might look like. And by the way, the IVF doc is a member of the church. So It's like the disconnect for the practical application of this, just like with the life issue. If people will not come to their pastoral leadership if nothing is ever said about the issue, because it communicates they don't have anything to say.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be a support to pastoral staff in starting this. I wanted to be a support to individuals. I wanted to be a partner with churches and counseling teams and congregational care and senior care and women's ministry, just mm-hmm. because I have now an expertise and they have the burden of trying to minister to a very wide range of people with very wide ranges of issues that they're dealing with and brokenness that they're dealing with.
Well, Christine, it's been so good to visit with you today and just appreciate the work that you're doing and so glad that you're willing to share it with us, with our Thank audience. You. Yeah, look forward to when you and I can catch up again in person, maybe at the summer conference this year.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, I really love that. Thanks, Matthew. I appreciate all that you do, all that CBHD does. It certainly was and still is kind of a heavy education for me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Christina Twitty, one of our MA Bioethics degree program graduates, and as you heard, someone who cares deeply about others. As a reminder, the deadline for paper proposals for our 2022 conference has been extended to Monday, December 6. For more information and to submit a proposal, visit cbhd.org and choose Call for Proposals from the conference drop-down menu at the top of the page. You've been listening to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, copyright 2021, all rights reserved. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is a Christian bioethics research center at Trinity International University, exploring the nexus of biomedicine, biotechnology, and our common humanity. Our website, cbhd.org, has a wealth of materials on a wide range of bioethical issues. For more information about the center and to support the work of the center, and projects like this podcast, please visit our website, cbhd.org. My name is Matthew Epinette, and I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Thank you for listening to the Bioethics Podcast.